From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The first ever Native American Presidential Forum took place this week in Sioux City, Iowa, drawing 10 of the Democratic presidential candidates, including three of the four frontrunners, Senators Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Kamala Harris. Former Vice President Joe Biden chose not to attend. At the forum, named after the revered indigenous activist Frank LaMere, who died just months earlier, candidates were questioned by a panel of experts. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who last year took a DNA test to prove she had some genetic Native ancestry, apologized for her actions. She also released a lengthy and detailed plan for addressing the issues important to the community if she becomes president. My guest is Judith LeBlanc, member of the Caddo Tribe of Oklahoma, executive director of the Native Organizers Alliance, a national organizing and training Native network. She attended the forum. Welcome to the program, Judith.
Nice to be with you, Sonali.
How important was this forum, and why has it taken till 2019 to have a Native American presidential forum?
You know, our ancestors have been walking the path to this first ever Native presidential forum forever. And I think the reason why this forum was such a bombshell in a lot of ways for both Indian country and for the electoral arena is that Native peoples have interrupted the narrative. We've interrupted the narrative starting at Standing Rock, really, where millions of people around the world saw and heard indigenous leaders speak about a clear and present danger to Mother Earth. And from there on, we saw the momentum pick up. Many, many people, the 10,000 people who were there, went home and said, we want our own Standing Rock. And some of the Standing Rocks happened at the ballot box, because in the midterm elections in 2018, we had the largest number of candidates, Native candidates ever to run. And we elected for the first time in hundreds of years since the Congress was formed, two Indian women elected to Congress. And so this presidential forum was the natural outgrowth of interrupting that narrative at Standing Rock and the grassroots empowerment kind of momentum that came from Standing Rock and the actual grassroots realization that if we don't run and if we don't vote, then policy shifts of any sort are not going to happen.
I understand that there was also history made in the fact that there is a Native American presidential candidate who's running as an independent and therefore has not been sort of counted among the Democratic contenders, Mark Charles. How was he received at the forum?
Of course, one of our own. He was received warmly. He actually met with the hundreds of young people who had come to participate and to help volunteer at the forum, and they had a beautiful exchange. And the truth is, for most of your listeners, probably they don't understand how our people have never seen role models in the national political arena until our two congresswomen were elected. I almost broke down in tears. I was on Pride Weekend. I was watching a CNN documentary. And suddenly, I saw on the screen one of our congressional reps from Kansas talking about being gay and what it's like as
Charisse
an indigenous
Davis.
Leader.
Yeah.
Charisse Davis from Kansas.
And the other candidate being Deb Haaland, or congressional member of Congress now.
Yeah, Deb Haaland from New Mexico. And Charisse was talking about being gay, not talking about being Indian, but talking about being gay. And Deb Haaland, Congresswoman Deb Haaland, I saw her during the government shutdown talking about its impact on Indian country, its impact on the country. And so for many of our young people, it's the first time we're seeing our own people in this larger body of political dialogue and debate. And so seeing a presidential candidate was so exciting for our young people and for people across the country in our virtual audience. And he spent a good deal of time with them talking about what it takes to make transformational change in the U.S.
Let's talk a little bit about Senator Elizabeth Warren, who has had, let's just say, some tension with Indian country. President Trump, of course, began the whole foray with using a slur to describe her repeatedly. He has called her Pocahontas because he has found that she had claimed at one point Native American ancestry. And then, unfortunately, she made a giant misstep last year in taking this DNA test. We had covered it on our show, and a lot of folks in the Native community were angered by what she did in reducing the identity of being Native American to genetics. So she apologized, and we'll play that apology in just a moment. But overall, do you think that people were skeptical of Warren or forgiving?
I have to say, hundreds of people and many in the virtual audience who were watching the live feed felt very forgiving. And you know why? Because from an indigenous point of view, indigeneity, being Indian is about how you walk, how you live, what your outlook is. It's a cultural, it's a community-based experience, as well as racial. And I think she made a mistake, but what she did to make up for that was not only to apologize, which many were hoping she would do, but also to make programmatic proposals about how Indian country, under her presidency, would have a different status. Number one, she's the only candidate that's actually proposing a cabinet-level appointment. She's against the pipelines. She is not taking money from fossil fuels. And so the audience and the Indian electorate is very sophisticated. They're listening. We're all listening to the programmatic proposals. Julian Castro as well has put out a platform. And the truth is, that's why the Indian electorate is so important. The Indian vote is so important in 2020 because we're sophisticated and we are the swing vote in seven states. Where 77 electoral votes hang in the balance. And so these presidential candidates who came to the Frank Lemire presidential, Native presidential forum, understood the math, but also most of them, we felt from listening to them, understood the healing and actually the spiritual impact of being connected to indigenous communities who have suffered under U.S. government policies for hundreds of years, so that they understand in sense of a values-led approach to politics that they needed to come to this forum. Now, I can only imagine that Senator Warren was nervous. She, all Indian crowd, all Indian panel. But the truth is she had the courage of her convictions, that she knew she did something wrong and that she hurt people and that she hurt us politically by playing into that racist framework about who is Indian and who is not.
Let's take a listen to what she had to say on stage at the first ever Native American Presidential Forum.
I want to say this. Like anyone who's being honest with themselves, I know that I have made mistakes. I am sorry for harm I have caused. I have listened and I have learned a lot. And I am grateful for the many conversations that we've had together. It is a great honor to be able to partner with Indian country. And that's what I've tried to do as a senator. And that's what I promise I will do as President of the United States of America.
And that's Elizabeth Warren saying, I am sorry for the harm I have caused. Judith LeBlanc, you attended the forum. What was remarkable about this apology was that it actually was an apology, because so many times when high-profile people apologize for doing terrible things, they will say, I am sorry if you were offended. I'm sorry if you took my words the wrong way, which is not really an apology. So she just straight up said, I'm sorry for the harm I caused. That was, I thought, significant.
Very significant. And I think that the electorate as a whole, and especially in Indian country and other communities that have been impacted by systemic racism, when a white candidate comes into our communities, we listen with a very sensitive ear. And the truth is that the crowd responded so strongly because most politicians don't take the time to really consider their actions and their impact on Indian country. So there was a very heartfelt response. But I have to say that, the attacks that Trump has made on her affects all of us. When he taunts her with a racist stereotype, it has an impact on the political atmosphere, reinforcing racist stereotypes, reinforcing the attitudes that actually stand in the way of expanding democracy, that stand in the way of addressing the central problems that all working class peoples, all of the peoples in this country have to address. And Trump is using racism in some ways, a very sophisticated way. He's targeted immigrants, he's targeted Indians, he targets where people are vulnerable. Majority of people, about 39% of people in this country, don't think we even exist. And in the states where we, in these seven states where we are the swing vote, is where you see the greatest impact of systemic racism. For example, in Montana, 7% of the population is Indian, but 39% of the women in prison are Indian. So systemic racism plays out in a very sharp way where we live, but then you have that 39% who think we are all gone, that we're peoples of the past, when in actuality, we are very much a part of the 21st century, and we are part of that movement of taking the country in a progressive direction when it comes to meeting the needs of not only our people, but all people.
So, Judith, let's talk about the issues that the panelists brought up. And actually, even before we get there, what was your opinion of the format of the panel? Because the previous places where candidates have had a chance to talk have been within a debate format where they have, you know, 1 minute to answer a question or, you know, 15 seconds to do a follow-up, and there's two or three sort of gatekeepers from the mainstream media that lob questions at them, often echoing right-wing talking points. In this situation, you had a panel of experts, with each candidate one-on-one. And I understand they were questioned for about an hour on a variety of topics. Did you find that this format was just better at figuring out where each candidate stood than the standard debate format?
Absolutely. You know, Four Directions and Native Organizers Alliance began talking about this idea of having the first ever Native presidential forum at the beginning of this year. And we knew that there had to be a dual-edged purpose. One, to invigorate and energize the Indian vote and help educate the Indian vote about the role and the impact and the importance that we will play in 2020. And the second was to educate the candidates and the general public about our issues, our concerns, but also our opinions about how to solve many of the problems. So we intentionally created an atmosphere for that dialogue and that dual-edged purpose. We had seven panelists to remind the candidates that there are seven states in which we have the swing vote, and that there are 77 electoral votes that will be determined by our vote, but also because many of our tribes work from the framework of thinking about seven generations ahead. How will we walk today to ensure that seven generations ahead live in a good way, and looking back seven generations of what did our ancestors do so that we can continue to survive and revive no matter what the obstacles are. I think the format was important because it allowed for tribal leaders and Native community and traditional leaders to express their opinions. Some might say maybe we spoke too long, but it is important, and it was like a history lesson and a contemporary current affairs classroom for the millions who read about what was said at the forum in the mainstream media. But in those live feeds, we had 1,000 members, for example, of the Native American Rights Fund, 1,000 people on their website, for example. So many of the Indian organizations were educating their base about our approaches to the issues in this election, the key issues.
Right. I'm assuming Standing Rock came up during the conversation and the broader issue of climate change. I also understand that a very important issue, which of course Native community organizers have been talking about for a very long time, is the problem of the hundreds of missing and murdered Native American women. And also two of the newest issues are the Bear's Ears Monument in Utah and the struggle around Mauna Kea and the 30-meter telescope in Hawaii. Were all of these issues raised, and did panelists get a chance to pick the brains of candidates on these issues?
Yes. And because there were 11 candidates and...
Right, 10 Democrats and one independent.
Mm-hmm. Right, 11 candidates and 7 panelists. So yes, there were questions asked. I think the really important element of the dialogue on the issues of murdered and missing Indigenous women and climate crisis is that those two issues were clearly linked over and over again. Hmm. That what is being done by the fossil fuel industries to Mother Earth, it generates the kind of violence and violent framework that has caused so many of our women and our children, both girls and boys, to be kidnapped, murdered, and used in human trafficking. So I think that relationship between those two issues, which are directly connected, was made over and over again. I also think some of the proposals about how to respond to the crisis, I mean, that is really, really an important element of the work that Native Organizers Alliance is doing in Indian Country. We are working on the KXL pipeline with the tribal leaders and traditional leaders who have been leading that fight for nearly a decade to oppose that pipeline. But we've been working with them to ensure that each tribe has a tribal code to deal proactively with the clear and present threats to our communities that man camps will present if and when the KXL pipeline is right. is built. So we feel it's very important in the sense of tribal sovereignty that the issues of pipelines and fracking be directly linked to the dangers to women and children that these fossil fuel projects create.
So we talked about Elizabeth Warren, but of course Bernie Sanders was also there. Kamala Harris was also there. Those two are also among the front runners. Notably, Joe Biden was not there. What were your impressions of Sanders and Harris and of the fact that Biden chose to not attend?
Well, I think the Biden campaign will be influenced by what happened on Monday and Tuesday of this week. We got tremendous media coverage from the New York Times, from CNN, MSNBC, and we made sure that we reminded people about those 77 electoral votes, and I'm sure he'll feel it was a missed opportunity since he is centering his campaign on the issue of systemic racism. My impressions actually are that, we have some good allies who are running, many, not just Bernie or Kamala Harris. Julian Castro was the first to put out a very detailed platform. He, as well as he ensured that he consulted far and wide in Indian Country about what should be in his platform. He has familiarity with Indian Country from when he was the Secretary of HUD. So, and in President Obama's cabinet. So my impression is that all of the candidates who came, all of them, they came because they want and need a closer relationship to Indian communities in order to be effective. And they all said that they wanted an administration across the board, they said. They wanted an administration, if elected, that would reflect who is America, who are the people that they are going to be representing. And that means, you know, the administration having, you know, prominent places for Indian people to serve and for Indian policies, tribal sovereignty to be at the center of the policies that they developed. You know, President Obama was the only president in history who convened on an annual basis for 8 years, all of the tribal leaderships at a summit at the White House to discuss policy issues. It has never happened before, and it was an important, lead to many of the candidates in this race that Indian and tribal sovereignty is a huge factor in determining how do we deal with the Superfund sites. A majority of the federally designated Superfund sites are on Indian reservations or public land. How do we deal with the role and the impact of fossil fuel corporations and the extractive energy industries? How do we deal with them vis-a-vis the fact that Indians are the only peoples in this country who have collectively owned land base that we govern, self-government, and that much of the extractive industries are related to or on Indian lands. So, you know, the Obama administration recognized that, and these candidates are coming to grips with that reality.
Finally, Judith, what about the issue of voting rights? There was a very important case in North Dakota where court upheld new laws that have stripped many Native voters of their right to vote. Was that an issue that was raised at the forum? And is that the sort of next frontier of challenges between now and Election Day next year to ensure that the voting power of Native communities is as strong as possible?
Absolutely. It was raised over and over again on Monday and Tuesday during the forum. Native Organizers Alliance partnered with Four Directions to work in North Carolina, North Dakota, as well as in North Carolina right now, but in North Dakota, to mobilize and protect the Indian vote in the 2018 elections. Native Organizers Alliance worked on Standing Rock with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. And we organized the vote based on indigenous ways of organizing through circles. We worked with over 100 volunteers for 3 weeks. Once that court decision came down a month before the elections, we began within days to build out a circle of people who are respected leaders on the reservation. And from there worked outward and outward circles, bringing more and more, so that we had over 100 volunteers working every day of the week for 3 weeks. We had a 94% voter turnout, and we increased early voting by 300%. And the reason why is that the volunteers saw the direct connection between DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the fight to stop that pipeline, and the elections and voting power. And there were many who said, we've been waiting since the Dakota Access Pipeline to do something for our people, and this is it. So I predict we're going to have the largest voter turnout, Native vote turnout ever. We're going to be concentrating in 5 of the 7 states. Four Directions will be concentrating in all 7 states. And we have support Indian countrywide for mobilizing the vote, ensuring that people get registered and that people get to the polls. Because the truth is, when we mobilize in federal elections, we are also gearing up for our own elections. When you have an invigorated Native and tribal community electorate, that means they will be tuned in as well to the issues in our own tribal government elections. So it strengthens democracy in every kind of way that will benefit in the long run achieving tribal sovereignty.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Judith. Really appreciate it. And we'll link to the streams from the recorded panels from the first ever Native American Presidential Forum from our website, so people who missed it can actually watch it in its entirety. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Sonali. See you soon.
My guest has been Judith LeBlanc, member of the Caddo Tribe of Oklahoma and executive director of the Native Organizers Alliance. We've been discussing the first ever Native American Presidential Forum, which Judith attended. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.